This is the Fantasy Focus Books and Authors Podcast, Episode 9. Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Fantasy Focus Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what it says it is, a show focused on everything in fantasy books. So we've got epic fantasy, urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, everything else in between, all here for you, along with the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy book world, here on the Fantasy Focus Podcast just for you. So what have I been up to this week? Well, as always, if you think about what I've been up to, you'll see that I've been writing, continued to work on the Urban Fantasy Game Lit series that I'm co-writing with someone, and I'm excited to continue working on that project. It's kind of challenging. There aren't a lot of urban fantasy video games and RPGs out there. And so it was hard to kind of find something that I don't want to model it after, but I wanted to make sure that we were hitting all the right notes as far as what people expected. Sometimes that can be freeing, though, so I'm excited to kind of invent a few things that make it more an urban fantasy twist on the game-lit genre rather than the typical epic fantasy you see out there. Also, I will be continuing to work on this podcast. We've got a lot of great authors coming up. I actually record this pretty much every Thursday. I record two or three interviews, and that's been a lot of fun to keep up with and meet some great authors, and I'm looking forward to doing that again this week, too. As always, though, if you want to find out more about what I'm up to, you can check out my fan group over on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Superfans, and also related Facebook author page, and on my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. And I hope you'll check me out over there. There's also links to my Twitter and everything else. And always love to hear from you, however you want to communicate. Now it's time to get into our special guest for this episode. Today I chat with Miles Cameron, also known as Christian Cameron. He's a Canadian novelist who was educated and trained both as a historian and a former career officer in the U.S. Navy. His best known work is the ongoing historical fiction series, Tyrant. Let's check out our chat with Miles. Hey, Christian, I just want to welcome you to the show. People might also know you as Miles Cameron, but your name is Christian, and we've got you here on the program. So I just wanted to welcome you. Thank you for coming on the Fantasy Focus Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'll do my best for you, whichever name you use.
Awesome. So why don't you take a second and introduce yourself to our audience, tell them a little bit about your background, and what got you started writing?
Okay, so my first name, Christian Cameron, I write historical fiction. I used to write thrillers and spy novels. I'm a former military intelligence officer, so I have some vague idea how that world works. And I got into writing because my dad is a writer. I know that probably sounds a little nepotistic, but I grew up with it, and I've always enjoyed writing myself, and at a certain point in life, it seemed like I should start writing not for my own entertainment or for my Dungeons & Dragons group, but maybe for more people. And as Miles Cameron, of course, I write fantasy, which is a little different, sometimes very different, sometimes very much the same. We can have a whole conversation about that. My background, I did a whole first career in the United States Navy, and I have a degree in medieval history and another one in classics.
That sounds awesome. And we will talk about how fantasy reflects the real world. I think that's a great topic to jump into at some point. But before we get to that, you kind of have a lot of different interests. What drew you to start writing in fantasy after you'd been writing in those other genres?
Well, the funny thing is that from a reading perspective, it would always have been fantasy first. I didn't start reading historical fiction until later in my life, and I've always read fantasy. I still read it for pleasure. So in a weird way, it's almost backwards. I recognize that I wrote historical fiction first, but I sort of thought in fantasy. And in fact, I was initially really heavily encouraged to go into historical fiction by a fantasy bookstore who occasionally carries historical fiction, nor do I see the two as being so very far apart, which I realize can be a contentious thing to say. But again, I started historical fiction because I was learning ancient Greek as a 45-year-old, and it seemed like a whole world. And that's why it's like fantasy. learning about ancient Greece and learning a language really put me, made me think of J.R.R. Tolkien a lot and how language-based his fantasies were, because learning an ancient language is, I don't know, it's like a key to unlock something that is very different from our world.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I think so many of our fantasy memes and tropes are really based on a lot of ancient cultures' mythologies, like Norse mythology and the connection to Tolkien and some of the other things that are out there. You know, I think that it makes perfect sense to me that history and historical fiction would tie in with fantasy in that way, because people in past times had a fantastical view of the world.
Absolutely, they did. And I think that their fantastical views still sort of feed us. But at the same time, whether you're talking about clothes or boots or arrows or swords, we kind of don't really have any understanding of how anything would work except the stuff that has worked, if you know what I mean. So while there is sort of a new tendency in things like video games to produce maybe things that couldn't possibly work, but they work in the game, and that gives us a suspension of disbelief, by and large, when you're writing fantasy, you still are working on that, the material culture of cultures that existed, whether they're Eastern or Western or Arab or Western European, or as you say, you know, when you deal with mythologies, those are intellectual cultures, and you have Norse and you have Greek and you have Hittite and Gilgamesh, and, you know, all of them give you a different entry into monsters and excitement and magic, but those are all culturally based. Anyway, I don't want to bore you with my views on this, but it's very, very hard, I think, for a fantasy writer to completely leave behind the historical experience of the human race and write something totally new.
You won't get any argument from me at all, because I know for my own fantasy work, I draw heavily on different mythologies and different creatures and belief systems just to keep things interesting. And I want to tie those cultures into my books as well. So I do it all the time, and I own up to it. So.
Well, I do too. I never lie to anyone. I always say, yeah, heavily influenced by this and that and the other thing. Totally true.
Yeah. And I think that it's important for our readers to kind of get a glimpse behind the curtain sometimes to see where we come up with some of our ideas. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that we can put our spin on things, but there aren't that many new ideas out there, which is what you're really talking about. We all draw on common shared memory.
I absolutely couldn't agree with you more.
So we're talking about your book, Cold Iron, and the upcoming book, Dark Forge. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what drew you to start this particular series?
Well, since we started down a sort of line of talking about historical inspiration, I grew increasingly interested, and I still am, in governance, in politics, modern politics, and the world that's going on around us, and how I see it reflected in the past. And I could, you know, I could bore you silly probably, but got really interested in the interactions between the late Roman, the Byzantine Empire, and the Ottomans in the 14th and 15th century. Always something that interests me, something I've dealt with in historicals. But I was also getting really interested in the early European Enlightenment and what some people call in the Western world, the gunpowder empires, which is Mughal India, the Ottomans, et cetera, and trying to find a fantasy that would be more Eastern than Western, that would deal with some of the issues of today, refugees, race, that kind of ugly stuff, and still be fun and still be epic, still have magic, but maybe a more Enlightenment magic, maybe a more scientific magic. And then set against all that, I used to write spy novels, and I actually was an intelligence officer, and I wanted to write a fantasy spy novel or something that felt more like a thriller than like a military novel or an epic quest, something a little new.
Boy, you didn't just bite off a little bit there. You really got the whole meal worked into that idea.
you have to understand what I love above all things is research. I love doing research. And I probably read 300 books in prep to write this series. And then I sat down and wrote the whole series end to end. So it's all done. All three books are done, in the can, edited. Dark Forge is, so Cold Iron is the first book. It came out in August in England, October, United States. Dark Forge is out in England. It'll come out later this year in the U.S. and North America. And the last book, Bright Steel, will come out in June in England and a little later in North America.
So it's interesting you wrote them all end-to-end like that, because not every author works in that format. They might have an idea for an arc for their trilogy, but they don't necessarily have it all down before the release. Was that a challenge for you, or was that the way you planned to do it from the beginning?
That's how I always planned to do it, and I think I should say here without, I hope, sounding the least arrogant, I'm a professional writer. This is my only job. Those were my 33rd through 36th novels, and I love to write. I sit down and write every day. I write about 6 hours a day, and I'm pretty fast. So writing three novels in about a 12-month period is sort of my normal speed. That's what I do.
No, you won't hear me argue with you. I consider myself pretty prolific myself, and I try to, I'm a full-time writer, so it is your job, and you got to treat it that way if you're going to do it. So it makes sense to me. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, I did plan these out, and I'll go off and riff on your question. It is a little different getting to write a series in a row for me. It's almost, I won't say almost. It's really fun. It's fun to be allowed to do my sort of very best work, to write them all back to back so that I never lose the flow, never lose the feeling of the characters, never lose the feeling of the world. That was really fun. I don't usually get to work that way. Usually I'm writing, as I am now, working on a historical fiction, then simultaneously or slightly later editing a fantasy. So I sort of snap out of one and go into another. And it can be harder, as you no doubt know, because you're a professional, to go back and forth between a couple of books or a couple of ideas. That can take time and effort, and you may have to reread something that was research or whatever. So it is a different kind of effort, and I'll be honest, a more fun one when you can just, work cover to cover, three books in a row, and make them all fit together.
No, it's great to immerse yourself in the story that way and stay in there. I completely agree. I think that would be, I can see how that would work. And I agree with you. It is hard shifting gears. I write early and then do administrative and editing in the afternoon. And the reason I do that is because I have to have that break in between where I do lunch and work out a little bit and things like that to give myself that physical change before I shift my gears from full creative mode to editing.
Now that is fascinating to me because I know a bunch of writers, and all of us are very different. So your writing day is almost the opposite of my writing day. I start editing yesterday's work, and I put in 2 hours editing yesterday's work before I get to work writing new material. And I don't know, that works for me.
No, you're absolutely right. I don't ever tell any author that asks me for any kind of advice that there's only one way to do this, because as individual as people are, our creative juices flow in equally individual ways.
Exactly.
So Cold Iron is a story about a young mage. You said it's got some elements of spy novel in it, and some of that intrigue worked into it, political upheaval. This main character, I'm gonna try to say his name, Aranthar. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
Awesome. I never want to like say an author's main character name wrong, but you know, sometimes it happens. But it's very interesting, and I'm hoping to get a chance to read this. I've got so many books on my to read list with this podcast that I sometimes get a little backed up. But I'm really intrigued by the description on the sales page here, and. You know, that he's a mage, but it seems like he's got a shift in careers going on.
Well, I'm going to have to explain. I have a t-shirt from my friends that says no short answers. So
that's okay. This is a podcast. You've got all the time you need.
So one of the reasons I said that this was enlightenment, look, one of my many areas of study is philosophy. I enjoy philosophy. And so this world has had a revolution sometime in the past. I won't bore you with that. And as a result of this revolution, they have, dare I use this word, socialized magic. So everyone has access to magic. Everyone is a mage at a very basic level. And those very basic levels have to do with European-style peasants living a better life. So anyone can purify water, anyone can start a fire, and everyone has control over their birth control. And because of these three things, that would be, if you cast your mind back to the Middle Ages and Renaissance, a massive revolution in the European in the European Middle Ages. Clean water.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a nurse before I became a writer, and public health, the public health changes alone that happened in the early 20th century, late 19th century, were what brought about the industrial age.
Yeah. So having said that, when Aranther starts into the world, when you first meet him, mage would be too strong a phrase. He's a young man going to the equivalent of university, going to an academy to learn things. And he's still not sure whether he's going to end up as an academic or whether he's going to end up going back to his family farm. He really doesn't know where he's going with his life. And in fact, he's just purchased a used, very beat up, very old sword. And it's kind of the joke of the book that he doesn't understand how old the sword is. And he's sort of fallen in love with it. So he wears it, which gets him in trouble, sort of with the cops. And he carries it around everywhere, which exposes him to various dangers. And it is the ownership of that sword that launches him into an adventure that if he hadn't had a sword, he could have completely avoided. And by the way, that sort of gets at a core belief of mine. It's my experience that people who carry weapons are more frequently engaged in activities involving weapons. I don't want to make this super political, but I once had to do an exercise where they gave half of the participants, this is a military exercise, guns, and the other half didn't have guns. And it was remarkable how the half of the people without guns solved the exercise problems without guns. So Aranther is a young man with a weapon that he fancies, and he gets himself in trouble with it, and a lot of other things follow on.
Amazing. That's fascinating to me. Now I'm definitely going to have to read this because I'm very intrigued by the things you're proposing here. And it brings me around to something else you put in the questionnaire I'd sent out to you before we did the podcast. It says here that you are involved with reenactments and martial arts. Tell me a little bit about what kind of reenacting you do.
Wow, I do a bunch of different kinds of reenacting. So I reenact three different time periods. I run a group called Hopalogia, which in Greek means the study of stuff. That's stuff, like all stuff. And so we do ancient Greek, the time of the Battle of Marathon. We do 1380-ish, a mercenary company in Italy, mostly English, but also French and Italian and German and Hungarian and Turkish, because all of those nationalities were in mercenary companies in the 1380s. And it allows us to be very inclusive reenactors. We don't have to worry about people's skin color or ethnic background because we can cover off anything in our group. And then we also do, from time to time, loyalists in the American Revolution. So those are the people fighting for the crown against the rebels who some North Americans refer to as the Patriots. Anyway, so we also do the American Revolution. So those are the three time periods I reenact at the moment, and keeps you busy. Tells me a lot about material culture and how campfires work and a bunch of other things.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm curious as I saw that, how that translates into your books, because I used to do a good bit of live action role-playing and you know, foam swords and things like that. I made my own chainmail once upon a time, and you know, all of those things changed the way I thought about hand-to-hand combat with weapons. And it's not the same with foam weapons as it is, obviously, but it certainly taught me that there were some things that just were physically impossible that I would read about. And I'm curious how your use of reenacting affected the way you write.
Sure. So, first of all, I spend an inordinate amount of my time fighting people with swords in various situations with various swords. And I teach armatsari, which is 15th century Italian fighting in armor. And I do various other martial arts. And sure, that's very informative, although painstakingly describing a sword fight can be as boring as any other form of really boring, painstaking description in prose. And if you're a writer, you know that prose, it's got to be a little more exciting than all that. So we've got that on the one hand. Reenacting really, as you say, helps provide the kind of detail that can make a world alive. And I have no really short way of describing this, but if you want to know what the houses look like in a medieval town, you might have to go to Italy and look at a medieval town. But if you want to know what the food tastes like or the music sounds like or what it's like to be cold and wet in medieval clothes as opposed to cold and wet in modern clothes, or how maybe you're not as cold and wet as you expected, actually doing it and doing it really right with exacting standards on all of those things, the clothes, the shoes, and all of that, will give you some fairly solid data to examine how people lived in the past, and that can make for good fantasy writing. It could also probably make for really boring fantasy writing, so you have to be careful not to over-explain.
I completely agree, and you know, that's the trick, isn't it, right, for an author, is to give the reader enough detail to paint the picture, but not so much detail that they fall asleep reading it, right?
Yep.
So yeah. how do you balance that? Because you like you said, you have all this data, and so often in epic and high fantasy, people are looking for a certain higher level of detail, I think.
Yeah, well, now I think you just get into what you like, and one of the things I find endlessly entertaining about writing and being a writer is how very different everybody is. How different what readers want can be, so that one reader is saying to you, this is the worst scene I've ever read. Why did you waste my time with this long description of clothing? While another person in a similar Goodreads review says, this is the best scene I've ever read. This was exactly what I wanted. Now I understand everything. Oh, well, that's two readers' takes on the same scene. I'll be honest, and I'm going to sound like an English teacher. I write what I want to read, and I am interested in what people say online. I'm very interested in what people say in reviews. I have learned from reviews to do less of one thing and more of another, but ultimately, I'm writing the story the way I'd like to read it.
Yeah, I consider it me telling myself the story when I write. And
sure.
So I tell the story the way I want to hear it. And I too like to read, especially like the 2-star and 3-star reviews, because I think those people have put some thought into why they are rating things the way they are. But I don't read every review, and I certainly don't get hung up on it. I try to just learn a little bit from it every now and then if I think that I missed the mark in some way. So,
Yeah. And that, I think we are very similar people in this respect. I will read that 3-star review. Sometimes it's a 4-star review. I'm really like the ones that are really long. And I'm really annoyed when somebody gives me a 1-star review and says I didn't like it. But I'm a lot less annoyed when somebody gives me a 1-star review and explains what they didn't like. And sometimes I say, I don't agree with that. But I have also had experiences of saying, oh, I hadn't thought of that. That's a very interesting take. So, reviews. I've heard people say that you should pay no attention to reviews. I don't know. That seems a little insensitive.
Well, and I think there's two different ways to look at that, because you shouldn't pay attention to reviews from an emotional sense because they aren't personal. So but some people really take them personally. And if you're an author, I think who is tied, if some person is an author who gets really upset by reading negative reviews, and it makes it so they can't continue to write for a period of time, even if it's just a day, maybe you shouldn't read your reviews. So it all depends on how you approach it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I just wish that at all times, in all places, I could always remove myself from the review and just calmly, take it on board. I'm not always that great. Sometimes
no.
I'm annoyed.
Me either. Speaking of reviews, let's talk a little bit about, meeting readers and how we do that. Do you prefer meeting them in person, online, a combination of both?
Okay, so here's something. I actually love meeting readers in person. I don't mind at all meeting them online. I have a joking response to people who tweet me or write to me or email me, which is I'm not actually famous enough to ignore them. Because people will often say, wow, you wrote back to me. Yeah, I'm not important enough to ignore you. You know, when I'm George R. R. Martin, maybe I'll blow you off. But at the moment, I'll respond to anything you say. Actually, the truth is I'm endlessly curious to meet the people who read my books. And that's said from a whole bunch of probably funny stuff. Like, one of the things I'll say is that my dad is a pretty prolific writer who's, I don't know, published 31 books or something like that. And he writes excellent books. And he said to me one day years ago, you know, I've never actually met a stranger who's read one of my books. And of course, that's his generation. They didn't have the internet, right? They didn't have a way of necessarily hooking up. So maybe he goes to a bookstore, signs 10 books, but none of those people have ever read any of his books before. Anyway, it is very exciting, I feel. You tell me how you feel. I feel very excited to meet people who actually like my books. And then I'll step on from that to say, because I run a book tour in Greece, where I take historical fiction and fantasy fans to some of the places that have inspired me, and we talk about the history, and sometimes we talk about the fantasy, and often we talk about role-playing games because we all play them. I have never yet had a fan come on that trip who didn't end up as my friend. I've never yet had a person that I thought, oh, I don't really like you. And I think that is interesting and almost speaks to, like, I've also yet to meet a fantasy writer whose work I liked, who I didn't like as a person, if that makes sense. You know, I finally get to meet somebody at a con and I go, wow, you're Nick Eames or whatever. And it turns out that the man is as pleasant as his books.
He absolutely is. I interviewed him a couple weeks ago, and yeah, he's amazing. He's a lot of fun to talk with. We were having a blast. In fact, we had to cut the podcast short because we kept talking. So,
yeah, he absolutely is a very, very nice man. But I'll say, like, Sebastian de Castle, also a really nice man. And I'm relatively new to this, so I'm relatively new to going to cons and meeting people. So I'm just meeting people who are sort of household names to me, and I'll name one who was absolutely fantastic, Alistair Reynolds, the science fiction writer. So I ate his books alive. I just thought he was the best thing ever, and then I met him in person. He really is the best thing ever. Like, anyway, so that's sort of how I see it all. And I don't know. I like in person, but I don't dislike, chatting with people on Facebook or chatting on Twitter. I've come to really like Twitter. Is that odd for a 56-year-old? I used to hate the short responses. Now I understand that it's genuinely social and you can get in a conversation with a whole bunch of people.
I'm with you. I generally just like to connect with people. So if it's in person, and there's rare occasions when I'm at an event that allows me to do that, that's great. Most often it's online. A lot of times it's just responding to emails. And people, like you said, people are surprised that I actually wrote back to them. And it's well, of course I wrote back to you. You took the time to ask me a question or send me a comment.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it would be rude not to, right?
Yeah.
So what's next? You got that. You've got another project you've got coming up that you're working on finishing. You've got this current project that you're finishing. You said you're working on historical fiction. Is there anything in your fantasy novels or fantasy work coming up that you can talk about?
I can't yet. I'm going to be trying to sell a new idea in the not too distant future, probably in April.
Well, that's fantastic.
And I have three historical sort of in the pipeline that I have to write now because I got out of sequence because I spent an entire year writing nothing but one fantasy idea. See, above mentioned. So I'm sort of in debt to my historical editor, and that will take me a while to work my way out of. But I've fallen in love with this world, the sort of East meets West world that Cold Iron is about. I'm running I hope this isn't too nerdy for you, I'm running a role-playing campaign in it, and painting a bunch of miniatures for it and sitting around every day thinking, I really want to write more about this. And I don't think I will ruin the book or give a huge spoiler by saying that the protagonist lives to the end. Because he lives to the end and he's still only 22 years old, I figure I could probably get some more books out of him. So we have to see. I mean, I will, you're an author, you know how this works. I will make a proposal to Gallants, who's my publisher, and then they'll say yay or nay, and we'll see where we go from there.
Well, hoping that that happens, because it sounds like a fascinating world and story, and I'm excited to hear that you're so invested with it. I don't think it's too nerdy at all. I haven't even, you know, I've considered doing something with a role-playing game in my world in one of the groups I occasionally hang out with, but now you've kind of spurred me into thinking maybe that's something I need to do.
Well, I'm going to say a weird thing. Maybe it's not weird. You're a professional, and I think maybe you'll understand exactly what I'm trying to get at here. Like reenacting, and we talked briefly about how reenacting, and I totally agree that LARPing can do much the same thing, but like reenacting can give you a little immersion where you say, oh, that's what the food tastes like. Role-playing games can give you a lot of immersion. I think there's got to be lots of people who listen to this podcast who play role-playing games. And then, in addition, as a writer, having 7 or 8 really clever people bounce off the walls of my world is better than any amount of literary criticism, because they're going to pick it apart and say, why did that happen? Why did that work that way? How come I can't, you know, insert all the comments? And that can be super good for making your world real. And I'll give you a tiny example. One of my players is very active in her church. She thinks about things theologically. And even though this isn't a major theological thing, we were in the middle of playing and she said, you know, what's the religious symbol for this goddess Sophia? And I, who's the goddess of wisdom and who's sort of like God, a take on God, not really a very pantheistic God, but a female wisdom God. And I'm like, and the players in 30 seconds came up with one. They're like, it has to be a pearl in a shell because it's a pearl of wisdom. So there's a shell on all the chapels and it's got a pearl in the middle of it. And it's probably all gilded. You know, it's Baroque. That vision didn't come to me. It came to them. But now it's in my books. Hope that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And wow, that's very powerful and kind of fun, too. I bet you were excited as it happened.
I was probably like a kid in a candy store. Like, but this is the great thing about running a game, is that 8 heads are better than 1. And as people unfold stuff for you, you say, oh, that is how that works. And I won't give anything away, but in Dark Forge, there's an action sequence that is. So I want to assure readers, these aren't about my role-playing game. What happens in the role-playing game has nothing to do with what happens in the novels. The players go off and play sort of in a different part of the sandbox. But there is one thing that I hope makes all my readers laugh that was funny, and it happened in a game, and I thought, I'm just going to put this in. So far, readers in England have really liked it. So we'll see.
Excellent. Well, that gives everybody something to look for. Christian, thanks so much for coming on the show. But as we wrap up here, you want to tell folks where they can find you online or your website and where they can find you on social media?
Absolutely. So I am One Phokion, that is the number 1, and then Phokion on Twitter. And I'm very easy to find on Twitter, and I answer tweets pretty fast. Although a lot of people just ask me Greek research questions, which is also totally allowed. I have a fairly easy to find website because like most people in the business now, it's just my name. So I am ChristianCameronAuthor.com and I have free downloads. I believe in me. So I have like 5 or 6 short stories, including some short stories in this universe, which you can download for free and you can decide for no money whether you want like my writing style or not. And there's also a bunch of artwork, both my own and fan art and professional art, pictures from my various books. My old series is called Traitor Son, and it's a much more historical fantasy than the current, which is much more pure fantasy, if I can say that. So a bunch of artwork, maps for all my books, and some other content and some fan fiction. You can find all that at christiancameronauthor.com. And then I have a Facebook authors page, and I'd have to bring it up. Oh, Christian Cameron Author. Right. It is Christian Cameron Author. Sorry. Those are the easiest ways to find me.
Excellent.
And thank you very much for your time. I've really enjoyed this, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
I really appreciate you taking the time as well, and we'll make sure we have links to all of that in the show notes for this episode so people can just go there and click on a link and find you. Christian, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Have me again sometime. Take care now.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Fantasy Focus podcast. Make sure you catch up with us for more from the Fantasy Focus community group over on Facebook and over at fantasy-focus.com. You can leave comments on both places where this episode is posted and let us know what's on your mind and maybe nominate your favorite author to be on the show. We'll reach out to them and see if we can get them on for you. Also on the website, on each podcast episode post, make sure you click on the link to subscribe to the show. It's such an easy way to make sure you don't miss an episode. You know, episodes come out Monday and Friday every week, and we want to make sure you don't miss some of the great authors we have on here, and you can do that by subscribing, whether you're on an iOS or Android device, even by email, or even some apps like Stitcher and TuneIn. You can definitely find the show over there. Make sure you don't miss any of the episodes, though, because we've got some great stuff coming up, including L.E. Modesset, Kevin J. Anderson, Adrian Tchaikovsky, and Anthony Ryan, just to name a few of them. So we're going to wrap up the episode now and just let you know that I'm excited to be here. I love having these podcast interviews, and we're going to keep them coming for you. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book if you sign up for my newsletter over there. And I'm excited about that because I like to let you guys check out my stuff. You shouldn't have to pay a lot of money for a book when you can get a look at what I'm doing for free and decide if it's for you. So check it out over at jamiedavisbooks.com. Whatever you do, though, subscribe to the podcast and make sure you're back here for the next episode. In the meantime, I want to remind you to make sure you keep your eyes open, folks, because guess what? There's magic all around you.